Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. On Building Bridges, tens of thousands of Delphi auto workers face bleak horizons.
And it's a rather sad look. It's a rather sad look. And Ed Petrusky from Delphi, New York, member of Soldiers of Solidarity, and Jerry Tucker, former executive board member of the UAW, are with us to find out what's going on. And I can't help but say, you know, there used to be years ago when the first anti-affirmative action lawsuit really, or one of the first ones, came into play. We were chanting on the line and he said, what do you do when you're under attack? Fight back, fight back. Well, we now have Ron Gettelfinger, who is the head of the United Automobile Workers, saying that the UAW faces tough choices, and it sounds like he's getting us all ready for yet more cutbacks, and particularly to health care, et cetera, and Delphi is even in worse shape.
Ed, let's start with Yukisha, the Delphi worker. I mean, it sounds to me as if Gettelfinger is saying abandon ship. Why don't you give us some background before we get into the analysis of these most recent, of what came about, brought us to this point with Delphi?
Well, it's the, you know, the bankruptcy, number one, and, you know, the, by Steve Miller, the, you know, wanting to cut our wages down to $9.50 an hour. And
from what?
From $27, you know, with our benefits and everything. They're always complaining about the legacy costs and, you know, that our wages have to, you know, have to be cut in order for them to compete. This is where it all started, and this is what it's boiling into now. You know, now they're coming out with all these attrition packages and retirement packages and basically trying to get rid of the workforce by hiring, you know, replacement workers, temporary workers, what I don't know what you'd like to call them, at, you know, at $14 an hour, no benefits, no pension. You know, this is the future of the American auto industry.
Well, they're saying that 4/5 of the Delphi workers will be gone through this.
And that's, if I understand it correctly, more than 33,000 workers?
Correct.
Oh, gosh.
And it's not a pretty picture. And, you know, the attrition package that they put forward here with there's several different packages. All they've done basically is put everybody in groups. You know, they put the 30-year people in a group and given them the $35,000 buyouts there. Then they got the 27, 28, and 29-year people with guaranteed money there, so to speak. But if you add up the wages there, that's about $18 an hour, you know, what they're going to get for the next 4 years. But you don't know what they're going to get in health care because they don't put everything on the table. You know, we need Mr. Gettelfinger up here to put some pressure on them and draw the line and say, you know what, my people can't make decisions here based on what you're giving us. You know, basically it's coercion. We're being forced into making decisions that the company wants us to make and not making the decisions that we want to make. You know, we're being forced into this. It's just not right. We don't know what the wages are going to be here at Delphi. They haven't, you know, alluded to any of that, of what the wages will be after all these cuts. The 21 plants that are going to close, you know, there's just not enough information here to make a complete decision. I mean, this is a life-altering, you know, decision for a lot of people here.
And for those that do take the buyouts, are there any guarantees with regard to health care or pensions?
Well, this is what we're getting at here is we have the pension benefit guarantee through October 18th of 07. You know, a lot of people are unaware of this. That are in the 27, 28, and 29 slide, you know, they check the box that says, you know, yeah, I want my health care and everything to come from General Motors, my health care and my insurance and stuff like that. But 100% of their pension is coming from Delphi. And, you know, Delphi is a bankrupt company right now. The pension fund is way underfunded. And, you know, they were on the stand last week in New York. And, you know, one of the executives there alluded to that even if they get everything that they want, you know, the big picture of everything that they want, the concessions from the UAW, in 3 years, the pension fund is still going to be underfunded by about $3 billion. And that's about what it took, you know, Steve Miller to dump the pensions of Bethlehem Steel. You know, it took him about 3 years.
You know, the whole question of the bankruptcy, for me, it was very personal in an interesting way. I happened to be in the Southern District in the bankruptcy court the other week. And hearing a case of Noble Jewelry Plaza, which is a case where bankruptcy is being used by for essentially corrupt purposes. What else can I say?
Right.
And we were told that our case would be moved to a smaller courtroom because we had to make way for the Adelphi case that was about to be heard. And I wanted to say, let's build some bridges here.
Exactly.
The whole idea. And tell us now, Adelphi is an auto parts. They make the auto parts and so on. What is, just give us a sense, because I'm so angered at the Chapter 11, these bankruptcy cases that are being used as a ruse, really, to destroy the benefits and gains that workers have fought for decades.
Many, many years, yes. What are you asking me there,
well,
too?
Well, I'm looking at the whole question of Steve Miller. What the heck was really, there was no imperative for bankruptcy?
No, there wasn't. There was no imperative, and there still isn't. I mean, they haven't even, Adelphi hasn't even made their case yet of why they need to, you know, to cut the contracts. They haven't really put it all on the table yet. They're being put on the stand now, and, you know, things are starting to come out, you know, and that's why I think they're going with all these packages here, you know, and they want to bring in the temporary workers and stuff, and because, you know, they're afraid right now that there is going to be a strike, by Adelphi, which is going to shut down General Motors. You know, they're trying to get around this. And the way to get around that is by bringing in these temporary workers. Now, when they come in the door, they're allowed to vote after 90 days. They're allowed to vote. Basically, they're bringing in replacement workers for us. If we go out on strike, who do you think is going to be working? They're going to force these people to work. And then what do they become? They become scabs. It's just not right. I don't think they should be bringing anybody in to the plants and allowing this hiring, you know, to take place until they have all the information on the table. You know, we've been after full disclosure from the beginning here, myself and Greg Shotwell. I think very, very highly of Mr. Shotwell, and I don't think we'd be anywhere near where we're at right now without him. He has done a tremendous job of putting the pressure onto the International Union and onto Adelphi and General Motors, you know, that there are people out here that are willing to stand up and fight.
And he's another member of Soldiers of Solidarity,
yes.
Right?
Yes, and you know, he's trying to get some answers on the pension benefit guarantee. If this is going to be, you know, one of the key negotiating figures, we need that right now. We need that to be extended indefinitely. We don't need just another 2 or 3 years. We need that pension benefit guarantee to be all the way out indefinite for all the Adelphi workers to be covered. Because if they falter in 3 years and they dump the pensions on the federal government, General Motors is off the hook. And, you know, quite frankly, you know, I started with General Motors. I put 25 years into the plant that I'm in right now. You know, we have signs on the front lawn. I was telling Bill this the other day that allude to invest in your future, buy American. All right? I've done that for 25 years, and everybody has done that for 25 years. We've bought General Motors products. You know, we backed the company. We've invested our money into them. And this is the repayment we're going to get after 25 years. You know, while we were investing in the company, they were taking our money and investing it overseas. You know, and this is where everything is going, over to China, Mexico. You know, and there has to, we have to draw a line here someplace and stop it. And, you know, if it takes a national work day, you know, Bill was asking me the other night on, you know, what I think Mr. Gettelfinger should go after. You know, I read his State of the Union address. It's great. It's a great speech. You know, he talks about a lot of things in there that need to be done. But are they being done? No. You know, we should be doing this. We should be doing this. We should be doing this. But, you know, how about a National Unity Day of trying to unite all the unions in this country? And how about everybody just stay home for a day? Don't spend any money. Don't buy any gas. And let's see what these big corporations do then. Because we are the ones that built them into what they are.
To bring Jerry Tucker into this. Jerry, you've been with the UAW. You've been on the executive board of the UAW. You've been a reformer at the UAW. I just want to get your reaction to this whole Adelphi mess. I mean, to me, it just the strategy is abandoned ship.
Yeah, I think, Ken, that's right. And my highest regards for all the Adelphi workers. You know, they're faced with these incredibly poor choices that are being foisted on them right now. You know, these corporations, both General Motors, Adelphi, and of course there's others out there too, lately have been acting like they're somehow the victims in our society, when in reality they're part of a ruling elite that controls virtually everything that goes on. This whole bankruptcy, which Mimi mentioned earlier, the shift in the bankruptcy law that occurred in recent years, is a product of the amount of corporate power, how much capital can amass power in our government as well. I don't want to dwell on this while we're in this area, but the real victims here, and frankly, are the main victims of all of this, are the workers in the communities they live in. And even to some extent, those temp workers are hiring right now are being victimized by this.
Yes, they are.
The sad truth is that the UAW, they made a critical choice a number of years ago. It's almost 25 years now. The UAW decided to move away from some form, a modified form of adversarialism, standing up for workers, usually at least threatening to resist, and moved into a very corporatist policy, one which was called jointness or partnership. And they've been carrying that out. It's a sad but not really unexpected consequence of that relationship. That level of collaboration is hard for a collaborating junior partner to resist when the industry decides to go a different direction on them.
Well, you know, it's staring in front of me is Ron Gettelfinger's portrait, actually, and it's where he talks about, well, he's a proponent of national health care. Well, certainly so am I. And that there's no way the extensive health care benefits coupled with Detroit's declining fortunes have created a situation that was unsustainable, a reason the UAW agreed to the benefits concession. And now what we're really seeing with GM and Ford is in the next years, there's a plan to cut 60,000 jobs over the next 6 years, and they plan to close all or parts of 24 plants. Now, I open this by saying, when you're under attack, what do? Fight back, fight back. Am I be told, I dare say, that I'm very naive, that I'm not facing the realities. What is a poor labor leader to do?
Well, we're all being treated as if we're naive if we say anything about this. But let's take a broader view of this. They claim this is all part of global competition. The auto industry isn't affected by a global competition in the largest sense. This is still a relatively domestic or North American situation. All of the production that's going on in this country is that markets itself within the U.S. and essentially Canada is done in this hemisphere and in the Northern Hemisphere. This is a re-rationalization against wages, legacy costs, and a destruction of the cost of living of middle class families and communities at the same time. They're not moving production that they intend to sell in the United States to some remote part of China. The production that's essential to this country is going to continue to be performed here. Companies like Delphi, which were spun off intentionally by GM with this plan in mind, and in fact that was discussed in the early 80s as a part of their new competitiveness models that they were using at the time, and maybe some of you will recall that.
I do. I recall that.
Certainly in the early 80s, the term whipsawing emerged.
Yep.
Plant against plant. If you can make it cheaper than the other plant that builds the same product as you, we'll shut the other plant down and you can stay in business. That was a lie that was told to workers. And it was told to workers on the basis that you have to take care of yourself here. You have to be competitive with each other. Well, that's a wrong approach for workers to get caught up in. And when unions lead the charge in that direction, then they're not leading.
Exactly.
I agree.
Ed,
I want to end with you, and I want to ask you a very difficult question now. Where do things go from now? What does Soldiers of Solidarity do? What do you do? Where do things go with the Delphi workers from this point forward?
You know, we have to keep up the fight. We just have to, you know, maintain what we've been doing and get the message out to people. You know, I try to put the message in the plant every day. I'm constantly talking to people, and, you know, and the movement is growing. You know, it needs to get larger, and we need to get more people involved, not just, you know, auto workers.
And it needs to spread to GM and Ford and Chrysler.
Exactly.
As well, Ed. You know that. Because
exactly.
We got to have the size has got to meet the proportion of the problem.
And it's a very huge problem. And, you know, right now there's, like I said, with the, or like you alluded to there, Jerry, with the programs that they have out here, they are bad programs. And it's making people make decisions that they don't want to make. You know, I have so many friends in the plant right now that are 27, 28, and 29 years. I have 25 myself. You know, now they're trying to put me in a 26-year group where I could slide out, but I don't want to do that. I'm 48 years old. You know, there's got to be a better way here. You know, they need to start addressing some of the CEO salaries in this country. They're way out of control. You know, are they willing to take their cuts? You know, we just got to maintain the fight and stay in it and hope that we can do something here. I don't know what else to tell you.
let's add to that this whole Delphi thing is a harbinger for so many other workers in so many other industries across this country, much as PATCO was back in the early 80s. This is something that should be sending an alarm signal right down to the center of Washington, where the AFL-CIO headquarters, wherever Change to Win operates from. They ought to be setting their little clipboards and their little planning processes down and deciding when they're going to hit the streets. Take action because this isn't something that's just coming for a small group of auto workers in a big sense. It's coming for all the workers out there that are trying to make a living in this country.
A decent living, you know, and it's, that's great. That's, you know, we need to have something in, you know, in Washington. We need to get them, I don't know, wake them up there somehow. I don't know how it's going to happen.
I think I'm going to go to your first suggestion, Ed,
okay.
Which you called a kind of one day stay home. I'm calling it a general strike. But I'm serious. Enough is enough is enough.
Is enough.
What is on the horizon for...
I'm down for that.
13,000 Delphi workers along with 113,000 workers at GM face a June 23rd deadline of deciding whether to take these deals. They're horrible. 25 years on the job.
Yep.
Enough is enough is
enough.
Enough
is enough.
And we're going to have you both back because it's something we have to continue to speak about. And Ed Petrosky, Delphi worker and member of Soldiers of Solidarity, and Jerry Tucker, former executive board member of the UAW, we really have to come together as a class to support the interests of the workers. There is too much at stake, and we thank you, and
absolutely,
certainly a real heartfelt response.
Oh, and Ed, just briefly, the website.
Okay.
futureoftheunion.org, or is it com?
Com.com.
Okay, futureoftheunion.com.
Right.
Okay.
Thank
Greg
you
has
both.
Two really good, Greg has two really good live bait enamels on there. The last two that he's written are just, not that all of the ones that he has written, he is just, you know, I can't say enough about Greg. I just think he is, you know, he's been a pillar here.
I think you all are. I think we all have to be soldiers of solidarity with our sisters and brothers in the auto industry. Jerry Tucker, former executive board member of the UAW, Ed Petrosky, we will have you back again, and we will be soldiers of solidarity.
When you're bob in the doggy dug, when looking out for number one won't do. When you're broke at the end of your rope, the whole world is caving in on you. I think you need some solidarity. When you're trapped under attack, when the vultures are circling over you, when you're in hock, hit bottom rock, the rains of poverty are jerking on you, I think you need a shot of solidarity. When you're stuck knee deep in mud, wiped away by a flood or a hurricane, when you've been torn by some brutal storm, standing abandoned in the pouring rain, I think you need some solidarity. Not charity, but solidarity.
And that's Mike Stout, Soldiers of Solidarity. Mike is a wobbly. Mike is an activist, and he's a wonderful songwriter.
Has the Supreme Court made it easier to engage in a government cover-up by discouraging internal whistleblowing? Let's look at the recent holding in the Garcetti case, where Judge Alito, the Supreme Court's newest addition, tipped the balance. Steve Shapiro, Director of Litigation of the ACLU, joins us to dissect the case of the gagging of public employees and the case where the NSA invokes the state secrets privilege to spy on you. Steve, first, the holding of the Supreme Court in the Garcetti case. How seriously does the ruling that First Amendment protections don't apply to public employees who report government misconduct undermine the rights of whistleblowers?
I think it's a serious blow. I think it makes it much less likely that most public employees will take the initiative to report misconduct and what can rise to serious health and safety risks up the chain of command, because they now risk the possibility that if their supervisors choose to blame and punish the messenger rather than correct the problem, the whistleblower no longer has any First Amendment protection. The only recourse, curiously in this opinion, is to go public. A government employee who goes to the press may have more rights than a government employee who goes to his supervisor, but that's a very big burden to put on many public employees who are understandably quite reluctant to take such a public step with all the high risks associated with it. So I think it means that a lot of misconduct is simply now going to go unreported, uncovered, and uncorrected.
Well, I want to flesh this out more. Let's apply the Garcetti case to a few hypotheticals to realize its full impact. Wouldn't it silence police officers, for example, who fear retribution for reporting departmental corruption, or subdue federal employees who want to reveal problems with government, hurricane preparedness, or terrorist-related security? In other words, isn't the decision really a disaster in terms of exposing government wrongdoing?
Well, there are certain government agencies that are notorious for maintaining a code of silence and protecting wrongdoers rather than punishing them. And unfortunately, that is often true of law enforcement agencies. And this just creates yet another disincentive for the next courageous Serpico to go up the chain of command, as I say, and report the misconduct. Now, I don't want to overstate this, because what the Supreme Court was discussing in the Garcetti case was whether the First Amendment itself provided any protection to the whistleblower who finds himself either dismissed or banished to the equivalent of employment Siberia. There are some laws that state and local and federal legislatures have passed that in cases where there really are life-threatening conditions provide statutory protections for whistleblowers, but there are a lot of holes in those statutory protections, and the First Amendment was the safety net. And that safety net has now been taken away.
So while the decision effectively bars public employees from reporting misconduct to their superiors, it doesn't, as you've mentioned, prevent them from reporting incidents to the media. So aren't we just naysayers? I mean, isn't this much ado about nothing? After all, they can go to the media. They can go to the public. Isn't that a better venue?
Well, first of all, it doesn't bar public employees from going to their superiors. It simply says you have no First Amendment protection if you discover one day that your superior has chosen to punish you rather than to fix the problem that you have identified. It creates this very, very odd disincentive that I don't think makes any sense either in terms of how you want to manage the government or how you want the democracy to function. It is true as a result of this decision that a whistleblower can claim the protection of the First Amendment if he reports misconduct to the press and cannot claim the protection of the First Amendment if in the course of his duties he reports the misconduct to his supervisor. But I think that the average public employee is much more likely to go to his or her supervisor if he sees something wrong in the workplace, because that's a much less threatening step. That's what we train employees to do. And there's much less exposure for most employees, or they think there's much less exposure, than if they take what is a very, very drastic and risky and threatening step to people's careers, and that is to report their supervisors to the press for misconduct.
So while Garcetti strips public workers of their First Amendment rights and the public of knowledge of matters of importance, let's juxtapose this with the ACLU's challenge to the NSA's eavesdropping without judicial oversight or congressional review. Aren't these cases really about the extent of executive power?
Well, the NSA surveillance case is certainly a case about, I would not say the extent of executive power, I would say the abuse of executive power. And the interaction with the Garcetti case is when you have an administration that is, in my view, abusing its powers by disobeying clear congressional mandates and the Constitution by spying on Americans without authority, without judicial oversight. You don't want to put on top of that a constitutional doctrine that says employees who report that misconduct are left without any First Amendment protection at all, because then what you have done is made it easier for an administration that is already prone to be too secretive in its actions to become even more secretive by intimidating employees who might want to blow the whistle.
The first major court argument heard on the ACLU challenge to the NSA eavesdropping program really just concluded. Steve, review the two essential legal questions in this case.
I think for the listening public, there is really one essential legal question, and that is we now know, because the president and others in the administration have acknowledged it, that the federal government, the National Security Agency, for some period of time has been eavesdropping on the telephone conversations of American citizens. They say so far that these are only telephone conversations that are international rather than domestic, but that remains to be seen. But in any event, they have been eavesdropping on the telephone conversations of Americans in clear and acknowledged violation of a federal law passed in 1978 that says the only way the government can do that, whether it is to fight crime or for foreign intelligence purposes, is to go to a court and get a judicial warrant. This administration has chosen not to follow the route that Congress has laid down. It has chosen instead to disobey the law, and it is now in court claiming, in essence, that the courts have no authority to review the legality of the program.
Actually, it's quite interesting because there is all these technical roadblocks that are thrown up as well, i.e. questions of what you call standing, where they say there isn't a direct nexus between the party bringing the case and a specific injury that might have been caused by the acknowledged, as you mentioned, injury. How do you survive that? Doesn't the government always give the same arguments like they do in the NSA challenge or when you ask for the CIA to confirm or deny the existence of documents authorizing it to detain and interrogate terrorism suspects overseas, for example?
Well, the government is really making two arguments that are both designed to avoid any serious discussion of the merits. The first is the somewhat technical legal argument that you have described, and that is they come to court and say the clients that we are representing, who are respected journalists, scholars, criminal defense lawyers who routinely deal with clients and sources overseas, have not established that they have in fact been wiretapped under this program, to which our answer is, of course we haven't established that because you won't tell us that, but given the routine contacts our clients have with people in the Middle East, they have serious reason to suspect that they have been wiretapped. But the more serious argument and the more far-reaching argument the government has made here, and they have made in the torture case, and they make in the rendition case, and they have made over and over and over again in trying to shield their anti-terrorist program from serious public and judicial scrutiny, is to say this is all so top secret that we cannot even come into an American court to discuss it. And because we cannot discuss it in an American court, the American courts have no authority to review what we are doing. So in essence, we get to violate the law, and then we prohibit anybody from reviewing what we have done by invoking what is known as the state secrets privilege. And that's a very, very dangerous proposition.
You've been listening to Steve Shapiro, Director of Litigation of the American Civil Liberties Union. And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.